Aloha. Welcome to Island Issues, our weekly public affairs program about Hawaii Island's people, issues, and concerns. Now, here's your host, Sherry Bracken.
Aloha. Good Sunday morning. Welcome to Island Issues. We're here talking story every Sunday morning at 6:30 a.m. on Koa Country 107.7 FM and at 8 a.m. on Lava 105.3 FM. And if you don't listen on Sunday morning, the podcast for anytime listening is online at lava1053.com and at koacountry1077.com. Click on Island Issues and then on the Island Issues microphone. A couple of weeks ago, we spoke with HELCO President Jay Ignacio and Hawaii Island General Manager Kevin Walchin, and the subject of solar and photovoltaic came up. HELCO, our island's electric utility, currently gets 57% of its electric power from renewable resources such as geothermal, water and wind, and solar, which makes up a large percent. I wanted to talk more about photovoltaic and solar, so today we're talking with Marco Mangelsdorf. Marco has a company called ProVision Solar and is also head of the proposed Hawaii Island Electricity Cooperative. Marco received his PhD from the University of California and has been in the solar energy and renewable energy field since 1978, working on projects, presenting papers, and attending energy conferences and trade shows in North America, Hawaii, Europe, and Asia. I consider Marco the go-to guy for an understanding of photovoltaic and solar, and you'll often see him consulted as an expert or read his writings in the Star Advertiser and other places. Aloha, Marco. How you doing?
Well, I tell you, with that intro, I'll try not to suffer from performance anxiety, but happy Aloha Sunday, Sherry. It's really great to be back in the studio with you. I always look forward to this time together because I think I know the conversation is always going to go in interesting and stimulating places, and I'll do my best to follow in the footsteps of my friends Jay Ignacio and Kevin Walsh, and I can only hope that I do my predecessor's credit. So thank you again so much for having me in.
Well, I'm glad to have you here. And actually, that leads into the first logical question, which is, we have had you talk before about the proposed Hawaii Island Energy Cooperative. What is the status of that, given that you have to purchase an electric company to make that happen?
We are essentially in quiet mode. We don't have the power of the government in terms of playing some type of eminent domain or power play to make essentially a hostile takeover effort of Hawaii Electric Light Company, HELCO. So it really comes down to if and when HELCO's parent company, which is Hawaiian Electric Company, which in turn is owned by Hawaiian Electric Industries, it comes down to whether HEI at some point were to determine that it would be in their interest to seek to make a deal with us or anybody else for that matter to unload HELCO to HIEC. I continue to maintain very, very friendly and cordial relations with my friends at HELCO, HECO, and HEI, and we're not going anywhere. We'll just see how things develop and if at some point or not there is a willing seller.
Okay, and right now there is no willing seller.
If there is, they haven't come forward to me, and I think I'd probably be one of the first to know. So, yes, there's no willing seller at this time.
Okay, so let's talk about what I really want to talk about today, which is solar and photovoltaic. And I'd like to ask you, this is a huge question, start us out at the beginning. What does it mean if people have solar panels on their roof, solar hot water, photovoltaic? Give us a little bit of a primer in this industry, because I want to talk about where it is today and then where it's going.
That's a great question, Sherry, and I could speak hours on the subject, but I'll keep it down to a super condensed version. The solar energy boom has been happening here in Hawaii for pretty much the past 40 plus years. We are the most solarized state in the country in terms of per capita solar thermal, as in solar water heating systems. We're also number one by far when it comes to solar electric or photovoltaics per capita, per household. And the reasons behind that are we have the highest energy costs here in the country in terms of generating electricity and bringing energy resources in from very, very long supply lines. We have good sunshine. We're in the tropics, right? And we've had supportive governmental policy for decades, whether it's Democratic governors or Republican like Linda Lingle a number of years ago. So there have been incentives from the state government in the form of tax credits. There have been incentives for solar water heating from the Public Utilities Commission authorized. So, you know, you kind of put all those tumblers into place, and we've had a very positive environment for solar to thrive here. That said, over the past several years, with the end of net energy metering, which was the best program for solar electric that one could imagine, where you put a PV system on your home or your business, and whatever you produce in excess to what you're using, it goes back to the utility company and they credit you. They don't pay you, but they credit you at the full retail rate, whatever that happens to be. And FYI, the residential HELCO rate right now is around 35 cents a kilowatt hour, which is actually about a 30% increase from a year ago. So prices are trending up. Two reasons behind that are there was a recent base rate increase for HELCO that the PUC approved, and also the price of oil now is pushing over $60 a barrel compared to about a year ago when it was in the mid-40s range. So as energy costs go up, conventional energy costs go up, solar by comparison becomes more desirable and more cost-effective.
You spoke about net energy metering no longer being an option. So if somebody puts photovoltaic panels, solar panels on their roof with the intention to produce all the electricity that they can use, but if they have excess, what happens to it? Does it still get fed back to HELCO?
That's a great question, because this is a very, shall I call it, dynamic environment in terms of what's available when as far as interconnect agreement options. And it was not less than 2 weeks ago that the HELCO, HECO-MECO companies filed with the Public Utilities Commission the paperwork for two new programs, which are now available to ratepayers across their service territories. One is called Customer Grid Supply Plus, or CGS Plus for short. The other is called Smart Export. Customer Grid Supply Plus is, in a sense, kind of NEM light, in that you can provide power back to the utility company. However, rather than being credited at the full retail rate, which again right now would be about 35 cents a kilowatt hour, the CGS Plus credit rate is in the 10 to 11 cents a kilowatt hour. So clearly that's, you know, less than one third than retail. So it's not as attractive as NEM, but it is still a program which we in the industry feel is the best option available right now. Now, the other program, so-called Smart Export, allows for export to the grid, but only from 4 p.m. to 9 a.m., only from 4 p.m. to 9 a.m. So in other words, from 9 a.m. to 4 p.m., there is no export of your surplus power back to the grid. So that requires, if you were to go that route, it requires battery storage. What's the logic behind Smart Export? The logic behind Smart Export is that the utility companies typically have evening peaks across the state here, which means that the demand for electricity starts going up roughly around 5 p.m. when people get home from work, home from school, start cooking, start bathing, start cleaning. It stays high from roughly 5 to 9. So Smart Export essentially is allowing people to provide the utility companies power when they need it the most, when demand is highest.
And both these new programs, as I understand it, just went into effect on February 20th. What's the status of tax credits for installing solar, both from a federal and state perspective? Because I think in the past, folks have really looked at that as a good incentive to install solar.
There are still two tax credits available, at least two tax credits for homeowners to go solar. One is state and one is federal. The state is 35% of the cost of the system with various caps. That doesn't currently have any sunset date. However, there is a bill in the legislature right now. It's Senate Bill 2100, which would do several things. It would ramp down the state tax credit over time, which is perhaps not so good for those of us in the industry. But the silver lining in that bill, if it were to eventually get to the governor's desk, and we're still a ways away from the end of the legislative session, which terminates the first week or so of May. So if it were to get to the governor's desk in more or less its current form, that bill would also establish a tax credit, a new state tax credit for battery storage only. So what part is that the 80 some odd thousand net energy metered systems across the state of Hawaii The vast majority of them have no battery storage, which means if the utility power goes out in the neighborhood, their PV systems must necessarily shut down. So they have no value from their system if a grid outage occurs. If you add battery storage to your existing NEM system, then you have backup power. So it would be a big deal, in my opinion, if we were to get that one across the finish line with the state in terms of establishing a separate tax credit for energy storage. So that's the state side. The federal side is the investment tax credit, or ITC for short, and that is still 30% this year, 30% next year in 2019. In 2020, it goes to 28%. In 2021, it goes to 26%. In 2022, it goes to 10%. And also by 2022, the residential part of that tax credit is eliminated. So it would only go back to the 2004 version of the tax credit, which was for commercial PV purchases only. So that's the way it is right now. Now, Congress and the president could change that. They could extend the ITC further depending on politics in Washington, but that's the roadmap ahead that we have before us right now.
You mentioned that that credit would then only apply to certain commercial facilities, and here on Hawaii Island, I think there's something like 11,800 photovoltaic customers. 94% of those are residential, not commercial, so it really would not apply to a bulk of the folks here. Now, Marco, you've spoken about battery storage, and that is a big deal. So help us understand what battery storage is, how it works, and also what it does to the cost of your system. Some people who install solar thinking it's the way they're going to save money ultimately, but others just really want to be off the grid. They want to be self-sufficient. So talk about battery storage.
Sure. Well, one important thing to remember about battery storage is that battery storage does not in and of itself produce more power. It's not some type of magical device that produces more power than your PV system produces. I mean, the photovoltaic system is the active part, essentially, of a photovoltaic system, and the power is produced when the sunlight strikes solar modules. So the benefit of battery, adding battery to, as you mentioned, the more than 11,000 net energy metered customers here on this island alone, would do several things. Number one, it would provide backup power in case of some type of grid outage due to a severe weather event, and we need to look no further than places like Puerto Rico, South Texas, and Florida last year that were wiped out for a considerable period of time in terms of electrical infrastructure. So battery storage would provide backup power, and I kind of see it along the lines as an insurance policy. I mean, we're already the most insured species, or put it this way, we're already more insured now than we ever have been in the history of our species. We pay for car insurance, health insurance, home insurance, liability insurance, pet insurance, this insurance, that insurance. And not to say that people generally like to pay for insurance, but it's part of the fabric of society, right? So are we at a point now where homeowners and business owners will think, gee, I think I'm willing to pay something of an insurance premium to have the power on in case the grid goes dark? And that's what my company, ProVision, is trying to generate, that type of buzz. And it remains to be seen whether that'll catch on much or not, but I really do see it from the perspective of having an insurance policy in case the grid goes down. Another big reason also as well for battery storage is that it provides a level of resiliency and redundancy, the R words, to the grid writ large. I mean, if, for example, prior to September of last year, when Hurricane Maria just absolutely clobbered the island of Puerto Rico, and now, you know, 6 months later, 30-40% are still without regular power, if by having battery storage strategically placed around the grid, both sited, let's say, at power plants, substations, and also on the customer side of the meter, as we call it, or at homes and businesses, then you go from having a rather vulnerable utility grid where a major event can take out pretty much the whole grid or much of the whole grid. You go from that vulnerability to a more robust, resilient infrastructure where there will be fewer people who will be without power. So this is going to take time. There's no doubt about that. And it's going to take a substantial investment. But part of the so-called smart grid, which a lot of people have been hyperventilating about for quite a while, is definitely, in my opinion, part of that the new grid of the 21st century is going to involve battery storage, energy storage, strategically located through the electric infrastructure across a given service territory.
You know, I hadn't really thought about it from the perspective of the utility having battery backup. Right now, utilities generally, and let's take Helco specifically, they don't have battery backup, is what you're saying.
That is correct.
Okay, and let me take a brief pause to remind everybody, this is Island Issues, and I'm your host and producer, Sherry Bracken. Island Issues airs on Sundays on Hawaii Island at 6:30 a.m. on Koa Country 107.7 FM and at 8 a.m. on Lava 105.3 FM. And we also post all these interviews as podcasts for anytime listening at lava1053.com and at KoaCountry1077.com. Click on Island Issues and then on the Island Issues microphone. Next Sunday morning, my scheduled guest is Hawaii County Police Chief Paul Ferreira. Chief Ferreira took the position just a little over a year ago, and this is my first opportunity to speak formally with him. If you do have questions to suggest for Chief Ferreira, please email me by Wednesday at info@lava105.com. Today, we're talking with Marco Mangelstor of Provision Solar to get an update on the solar and photovoltaic industry here on the island. Let's get back to Marco Mangelstorf. For a home, the average home, tell us what the cost might be to put photovoltaic panels on your roof to provide your own power, and then tell me what the additional cost of the batteries might be.
Well, the cost of a PV system, of course, is going to vary dramatically depending on the size.
Oh, I know right?
that. Anywhere from $10,000 to $100,000, which, of course, is a very large swing in price.
Well, give us the average house, let's say, the normal three-bedroom, two-bath kind of
Well, I'll say just $30,000, okay. Roughly, give or take $5,000 or $6,000, $10,000. So in terms of an adder for battery storage, if you're looking, let's say, without battery storage, let's say it's $30,000 and you want battery storage, you're looking at an adder of somewhere in the $10,000 to $20,000 range, depending on the brand, depending on the capacity of the battery storage. So is it a trivial increase in price? No, it's not. But that said, the way we in the industry understand the tax code, both federal and state, that by having battery storage as part of a photovoltaic system also qualifies for the tax credit. So when you go from $30,000 to $40,000 or $45,000, that's a big jump. But you start whittling it down with tax credits, and it becomes a lot less of a bite out of your pocketbook. And there's no doubt as well that as more gigafactories, and the gigafactory is what Elon Musk at Tesla, or everybody refers to this great big plant, this monster. It's the largest plant in the world, in fact, outside of Reno, Nevada, called the Gigafactory, G-I-G-A. There are a dozen or so similar gigafactories either on the drawing board being constructed right now in places like China and South Korea. So the takeaway is, in the years to come, the availability of these kind of batteries is going to skyrocket, which means typically that as availability skyrockets, price goes down significantly.
That was really my next question, because typically when new technology is introduced, prices are higher, and then as time goes on, things get more efficient, prices go down.
Adoption goes up, economies of scale go up, and I mean, let's face it, our friends in China and our friends in South Korea, when you look at the history of just the past 5 or 10 years in terms of photovoltaic manufacturing, the Chinese have become, or over the years, the biggest producer of photovoltaic modules on the planet by far. The South Koreans are also very active, so there's no doubt whatsoever in my mind that they're going to also be leading the charge in terms of a dramatic increase in battery production. As availability skyrockets, price goes down.
The federal government has imposed new tariffs on photovoltaic panels manufactured outside of the United States. And then just recently, President Trump announced new tariffs on steel and aluminum. How do those things impact the solar industry here in this country?
Well, the feds, first under Barack Obama, there have been various trade actions going back to 2011, 2012. So we've been witnessing 5-6 years of attempts, not just on the part of the Americans, but also the Europeans, to try to limit what they feel to be unfair competition and dumping of product from China, principally. So we went through yet another round over the past several months where the US ITC, the International Trade Commission, voted last fall to impose tariffs on imported solar modules coming into the US as well as solar cells. And this was ultimately up to the White House, to President Trump, to decide. And he issued a ruling in late January that essentially ratified the ITC's decision. The takeaway is that the increase in cost to the end user, to the homeowner, to the business owner who's getting a photovoltaic system, the increase in cost springing from these tariffs is only marginal. I mean, easy for me to say, but it's true. I mean, it's not by a factor of 10% or 20%. It's less than 10%. But we don't know quite yet, Sherry, because prior to the decision, the strategy on the part of many in the industry here was to order so that they had huge stocks to be able to get in prior to the tariffs, the tariff drawbridge essentially going up. So we haven't really yet seen the effects of higher prices from our suppliers because most of them had been stockpiling prior to the tariff decision. Now, as far as this recent decision you alluded to regarding tariffs on imported aluminum and steel, I think what's an absolute lock is that whether it's the Canadians, the Mexicans, the Europeans, or the Chinese are not just going to sit on their hands and take kind of swallow hard as the Americans do that. I mean, we can only hope that we're not going to go down the Smoot-Hawley, harking back to prior to the Depression and a trade war, which led to, you know, the global recession in terms of trade restrictions, barriers, and so forth. So we're really kind of going into uncharted territory. And when you start slapping tariffs on mainstay products like aluminum and steel, that means a heck of a lot more to our economy than tariffs on solar modules, comparatively speaking.
Community solar. The State Public Utilities Commission recently gave the green light for more community solar, but it sounds like the Hawaiian electric companies have put their own limit on how much community solar can be accepted. And that, coupled with our own example here on Hawaii Island, where there was an attempt to put large solar arrays in Ocean View that was completely rejected by the community. Talk about community solar, how you see that working, playing out, whether it's going to be good thing, bad thing, et cetera.
Well, that's a great question. In fact, there was a really good piece in the Pacific Business News just on Friday.
Did you write it?
I did not write it. No, I can't claim credit for that. It's by H.J. May, who has been covering energy, the energy beat for the PBN. And he wrote a very good and in-depth piece on community-based renewable energy, or CBRE for short, also known as community solar. And the history of community solar goes back to my friend Senator Mike Gabbard, who got this bill passed and got it to the governor's desk back in 2015. So now we're 2018. And this has taken a while to gestate, so to speak. It's a priority for the commission, for our Public Utilities Commission, and has been for obvious reason. In principle, I support it. But in practicality, as a number of people in the energy field opined in the piece on Friday, it's a heck of a lot more difficult, more challenging to actually roll out and turn into a real-world practical program. So, I mean, the principle of community solar is that there's no shortage of people here in Hawaii who do not have their own home for which to put a solar system on their roof. They are living in apartments. They're living in condominiums. And community solar essentially allows them to have something of a fractional ownership or a fractional share in a solar electric system that is somewhere on the grid, that they can take advantage of some of the benefits of this community solar system somewhere on the grid. So in principle, you know, who could argue with that? But I think there's some very serious reservations by pretty much all the parties, including the utility companies and including a number of the green energy groups, that this is going to be a lot harder to make happen in the real world. And then finally, there have to be developers who have to be willing to come forward to do these projects, right? And they're not going to do it out of a sense of altruism with the expectation that they're not going to make money or let alone lose money. That's just not the way, you know, capitalism works typically. So what's clear to me and to a lot of my colleagues is that it's going to take a substantial amount of time, effort, and money to pursue and develop these projects with, at this point, a rather questionable, doubtful timeline in terms of when these projects would actually go live and when one would get paid to do them. So there are going to be groups that are going to be doing it, I'm sure of that, but I think there's a substantial amount of nervousness and trepidation. And again, from a business owner's perspective, from my perspective, I have to make a decision. What is worth the time and effort and money on my part and my company's part to pursue in terms of leads? I mean, this is something we have to decide day to day to day in terms of going down path A, B, or C. And the CBRE path right now looks rather uncertain. And there's a fair amount of nervousness on the part of those of us in the business about putting a whole lot of time and effort and money into pursuing it.
I would think one of the other concerns would be this, and you can tell me if I'm right. Right now, Hawaiian Electric Light Company, you can apply. One can apply to be able to put photovoltaic on their house and feed it back to the grid. And HELCO will allow that or not allow that, depending on how much energy is being generated. And I would think community solar would generate a whole lot of photovoltaic power, so that could be an issue. Tell me if I'm right or wrong about that.
No, I think you are correct. And in fact, this is a conversation I've had with Jay Ignacio a number of times over the years. And if you look across the state of Hawaii, the Big Island is the only island in the chain that does not have a single commercial utility-scale photovoltaic project here. And Jay's response, when he and I have discussed it, he said, well, we've made the choice essentially over the years that rather than have, let's say, a 5 megawatt, 5 million watt photovoltaic array, a utility scale array, we have made the preference to allow X number of thousands individual homes that would get to that 5 megawatts worth of solar capacity. So, I mean, being in the business of installing rooftop solar, I applaud and I appreciate his preference in that regard. But as far as community solar goes, I mean, it doesn't matter what nice label you want to put on it. As I've been saying over the years, and I'll say it again, every grid is finite. Therefore, the amount of power feeding into a finite grid must necessarily also be finite. It cannot be infinite. So there has to be a balance done that the utility company does every single day, 24/7, in terms of trying to balance load and demand, demand and load. And you cannot keep on adding to a grid unless you're going to be taking away generation somewhere else, or you're going to be putting storage in to sop up, essentially, excess generation. I mean,
battery, right?
Battery storage being one of them. There are also other types of energy storage, but battery storage is kind of one of the most commercially available, most proven as of now. So it remains an ongoing puzzle to put pieces together, have it all look right, have it all work right, with tens of thousands of independent little power plants on people's roofs, less than 10 or so utility-scale generation plants on this island, demand that varies substantially, whether it's 12 a.m. or 12 p.m. in the day, and the utility company, which does, I do believe, a superlative job trying to keep everything going as best they can. But it's a very, very, very dynamic environment, and CBRE is just another interesting puzzle piece that you got to try to fit in and have it all work right.
Some people have said that HELCO is being essentially willful in not allowing unlimited amounts of solar power to come into their network. And what you've just talked about is pretty much that they're not just being willful. But answer the question directly. Should HELCO just accept everybody who wants to put in photovoltaic power? Or given that you are a potential someday owner of an electric utility on Hawaii Island, should that ever occur? Not feeling like it's going to, but should it ever? Just talk about that. It sounds to me from what you've just said that there are significant challenges in managing an electric grid in any place, but certainly on an island even more so.
No, I mean, I couldn't agree more. And I kind of look at the analogy of you have a freeway. With a freeway, do you allow pedestrians? Typically, no. Do you allow people on their horses? No. A horse and buggy? No. It is a public good, and there have to be restrictions in terms of the type of vehicles or type of modes of transportation you allow on the freeway. Well, let's look at the grid. The grid also is a public good. Now, it happens to be a infrastructure that is effectively owned by a private/public company. I mean, public in the sense that Hawaiian Electric Industries is traded on the New York Stock Exchange, but it is a public good, and the electric companies have a fiduciary responsibility not just to their shareholders, but also to their ratepayers and to the public writ large. So even if I were to be the czar of Hawaii Island Energy Co-op and we were to own the grid here, we are also faced with inevitable limitations in terms of what power sources are going to feed into the grid at what cost, and try to come up with a balance. And this is the really hard part, Sherry. It's trying to come up with a balance between the lower costs of power, green power, because we all want to go in a more independent and green and reliable, green and groovy direction. But it has to be done cost effectively. And typically, larger power plants, whether they're wind, whether they're solar, biomass in the case of Huhonua on the Hamakua coast, they produce power cheaper. Whereas if you have smaller systems on rooftops, they produce power more expensively. So do you go full bore for the cheapest power and say no go to another 5,000-10,000 homeowners who want to do it, or do you go the other way around? And of course, the obvious answer is you don't go in either direction full bore. You try to find a balance between supporting the cheapest cost of new and existing renewable energy, but you also want to empower, pun intended, you want to empower homeowners and business owners to put systems on their roof so they can get a piece of the action in terms of becoming just a little bit more energy independent and a bit more resilient by, let's say, having battery storage. So it's truly a balancing act that is very dynamic. In the 18 years I've been in the arena here in Hawaii, it's just been it's been one heck of a ride. And I really do feel that we in the state are going where no other utilities in the United States have gone before in terms of both renewable energy deployment and also dealing with issues of renewable penetration into finite grids, trying to keep as many people happy as possible, trying to get the electric costs stable, if not bring them down over time. And it's quite the circus. But I'm very pleased to be one of the clowns.
Marco Mangelsdorf, before we say aloha, what else would you like to add?
Oh, we live in a wonderful place, Sherry, and it really takes a team effort. And, you know, whether you want to use the canoe analogy where you get the paddlers in the canoe and they really have to be part of a team, otherwise the canoe is going to not go where it's supposed to go or spin around in circles or do a hoolie. It's really a team effort, and I much prefer to focus on the things that bring us together and common cause rather than vilify or go after scapegoats or easily identifiable villains, and they're not villains at all, whether it's the utility company or whether it's the governor, whether it's the commission. I mean, we're really in this together, and I hope we can continue to work as a community towards the public good. I think we're doing more good stuff than not good stuff, kind of tortured English there, but I really do feel like we're going in the right direction because everybody wants to get to a better place in terms of a more energy-independent state, less dependence on imported fossil fuels, do our part for global warming, and all that great kind of good stuff.
Thank you, Marco Mangelsdorf, for being with us.
Anytime, Sherry. Thanks so much for having me.
Thank you so much to our listeners for being with us, and thank you so much to Marco Mangelsdorf. He's head of ProVision Solar and has been actively engaged with the Hawaii Island Energy Co-op, should it ever come to fruition. This is Island Issues. I'm Sherry Bracken, your host and producer. I'll see you next Sunday morning for another Island Issues. Until then, please, let's all live and drive with aloha. Ahui ho.
Thank you for listening to Island Issues. We welcome your comments and suggestions. Email us, info@lava1053.com. Join us again next week for another edition of Island Issues, a service of Hawaii Islands Mahalo Multimedia.